First Name Sports starts now.
We're kind of on a first name basis around here.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
Okay, let's get started.
From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
What's going on, America? It's Thursday afternoon on the Sports Map Radio Network. Almost dropped the ball there, but almost doesn't count, except in horseshoes and hand grenades. I wonder where that saying started. You know, I mean, like, only those two things. I don't know, almost isn't bad in golf if you hit your approach shot really close to the hole and you knock in for birdie or something. But anyway, as we roll on here, John Bellmer, our producer, a couple guests today from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jim Ozarski joins as the Milwaukee Bucks maybe just made another three. I mean, they were all going in. It was raining three-pointers last night in Wisconsin as the Bucks draw even with the Miami Heat. Also, we see the Memphis Grizzlies pull even with the Los Angeles Lakers out west. And we will talk with Jim about that Bucks Heat series in about 30 minutes. And then Lee Steinberg, the NFL super agent, joins in a little over an hour as we look back on the 25th anniversary of the 1998 NFL draft, which, of course, was forever immortalized by the first two selections, Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf. So Lee Steinberg was Ryan Leaf's representative, and we will speak with Lee Steinberg later on in the show. He's a guy that likes to do the interviews, and I'm sure he'll have some thoughts on the whole process and, this year's draft as well. But we actually want to start on the diamond. A couple of baseball stories that we will begin with today. And it involved a pair of big market teams yesterday and a big-name player who ironically has spent time, obviously, with his current team, but also with the opposing team in the game yesterday. And we're talking about the New York Mets and the Los Angeles Dodgers. And we're talking about the ejection of Max Scherzer yesterday, Mad Max. And say what you want about Max Scherzer. He's been a little outspoken against the pitch clock, and he's got two eyes of a different color, which is like kind of creepy when you look at, like, there's photos of it, and it's like, ooh. But he's obviously had a damn good career and is probably headed to the Hall of Fame. And he was ejected yesterday for failing an illegal substance check. And it was in Southern California. Seemed to be a pretty hot day. And he was using the rosin and also sweating a lot. And by itself, there's nothing wrong with that. But for one reason or another, and a reason that we might not hear about until later down the line, because there's been no, I don't believe there's been a statement released by Major League Baseball, or, you know, you don't hear from these umpires after games. Fred Fowler, who I worked with on this network last year, always said these guys need to be made available, because when there are bad calls or questionable calls, it's interesting how officials never have to answer to what they're seeing. And the funny thing about that is a lot of networks have a, you know, in the NBA, I haven't seen them in these playoffs yet, but Steve Javy, the former NBA official, would come on and talk about, well, what are the officials seeing on this play? Or Mike Pereira would come in on NFL Network and talk about, or Fox, I think, and talk about what the officials are seeing in this football play. Gene Steratore, who I didn't know reffed basketball as well, but I saw him on a lot of the March Madness stuff. He's been a well-known NFL ref as well. These guys are doing stuff with networks and on game broadcasts explaining why what the officials might be seeing. Now, that's one thing, but let's hear from the actual umpires or officials. And in this case, that's Phil Cuzzi, who has now ejected three pitchers for illegal substance checks. And this was what Max Scherzer gave, a very detailed explanation. And when after you're done listening to this, you'll probably think, yeah, okay, why'd he get ejected?
So after the second inning, my hand, it was a little clumpy from the rosin sweat, that it was clumpy, and Phil was told me to wash off, so I washed it off. Came back out there after the third, with alcohol, I washed it with alcohol and rosin, and when I went back out there, the alcohol for a little bit there can be sticky if in rosin, that can happen. So he was like, that's too sticky, you need to go back on there, wash it off again, and reapply the rosin. And so I did that, and then at the same time, he thought my glove had too much rosin on it. I was like, okay, if that's a problem, there's nothing going on. He's like, you need a new glove. Like, okay. So come back out, pitch a third, and knew I was going to get checked in the fourth. So I'd have to be an absolute idiot to try to do anything when I'm coming back out for the fourth. So after that third inning, I'm in front of the MLB official that's underneath here. I wash my hand with alcohol in front of the official. I then apply a rosin, and then I grab sweat. When I then go back out there, and Phil Cuzzi says that my hand's too sticky. I don't get it. Yes, when you use sweat and rosin, your hand is sticky. But I don't get how I get ejected when I'm in front of MLB officials doing exactly what you want, and being deemed my hands too sticky when I'm using legal substance. I do not understand that.
For as frustrated as Max Scherzer probably was and still sounded, he was, Belmer and I were talking about this in show prep, pretty diplomatic, pretty conversational, willing to, and, I'm sure that there were questions from the New York media contingent out there. And there was a little bit of a back and forth. He did not seem like someone who was off his rocker or someone who, did not have grounds to be upset and was just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what would stick. If he got mad enough people might believe him. Like, I he seemed like somebody that was legitimately perplexed as to what happened. And I think, what was it? I guess it was the fourth inning. So he had probably an hour and a half to calm down. And the Mets, I believe, won the game. So perhaps he had allowed his emotions to simmer a little bit when there was access in the clubhouse for the media. But it's when you listen to all of that, again, it's hard to sit there and say, well, this guy sounds crazy, or this guy, what's he talking about? Like, there was a check, and he was ejected after, washing his hands with an MLB official in front of him. What is the point of all of this if that can be exactly what happens and you still get ejected? And I mentioned Phil Cuzzi. It's not a whole lot that bothers me more, at least when I am impartial and don't have a dog in the fight in any sporting event for that matter, than the officials getting in the way of the outcome or making themselves the story. And that's the bigger problem I have with Phil Cuzzi. We've talked about it earlier this week with the Scott Foster, Chris Paul beef coming to the forefront again with, now Phoenix won the game on Tuesday night, but Chris Paul and Scott Foster were sharing the same court. Again, It's the same thing with journalists who don't vote for somebody for the Hall of Fame, or, you know, they do things just so they could say, well, everybody's going to be talking about that one guy that didn't vote for Ken Griffey Jr. on his first Hall of Fame ballot or something. It's almost like there's an ego element to it where they want to be the center of attention, even though that's not their job. I think a lot of the umpires whose names we know because they've been in the middle of controversies and they're bad umpires. C.B. Buckner, Angel Hernandez, Joe West, now Phil Cuzzy. Okay. I don't think this guy has a reputation as being a bad umpire, but Jim Joyce, we all know because he was the first base umpire when Armando Galarraga lost his perfect game. So basically, if we don't know who you are, that's a good thing if you're an umpire. Don't put yourself too much into the storyline than you already are by calling balls and strikes behind home plate or whatever your task might be with that crew on that day. And that's the concern I have with some of the changes in baseball the last couple years. If umpires are going to say, well, now I can get myself more into the story with the way I apply these rules, whether it be the substance checks or the pitch clock. And when you hear that it's the same umpire ejecting these pitchers for foreign substance checks that he deems to have, the pitchers have failed the checks, then how can you not think that that guy is making himself more and more a part of the story? It just doesn't sit well with me. It's not what the game's about. We'll take a timeout. Another major baseball story on the other side. First Name Sports, SportsNet Radio.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
Not that this was necessarily a huge surprise when it was reported by Major League Baseball insider Jeff Passan for ESPN. But I suppose if you want to get more into the weeds on the wording of the report, and that's what we'll do here, there were some things that you can try and read into. And the report involves one Shohei Ohtani, who, as many know now, is in the final year of his contract with the Angels. And I can't remember what the agreement was on his compensation for 2023, but he can become a free agent in the winter. And Jeff Passan's report is that Shohei Ohtani, quote, will definitely, end quote, leave the Angels if they fall out of playoff contention this season. And also could be traded. Now, the could be traded part is really where we'll start. And John Bellmer and I were talking about it a little bit in show prep. It's like, duh. This guy who's an insanely talented two-way player on a team that sucks seemingly every year, in a contract year, could be traded. Like, if the team that controls his rights has any brains, he will be traded. But let's remember who we're dealing with here. This is an Angels franchise that has managed to botch just about everything the last decade. Wasting Mike Trout, and now Shohei Ohtani. Big contracts galore, dating back to, I can remember, Albert Pujols and C.J. Wilson and Josh Hamilton, and I remember hearing the news in school, and you'd bump into somebody, in between periods, walk into your next classroom. Did you see who the Angels just got? C.J. Wilson. Now they got Josh Hamilton. Like, I remember that when I was in high school, and it never stopped, right? Like, they just kept spending money. Anthony Rendon, obviously they get Ohtani, like I said. I'm probably blanking on a few other failed investments from the Angels. And The results have basically been the same. Mike Trout's only been to the playoffs once and was swept out of the division series in, I believe, 2014. So the Angels would be the kind of team that would say, well, we'll just cut Ohtani the check and he'll come back and not trade him. Because let's remember that this was a team that was probably dumb enough to think it could compete this year and that this year would somehow be different than the last 8 or 9. And the reason I bring that up is because if I were the Angels, I would have traded Ohtani in the offseason because it allows me to open up my market for suitors a little bit more. And not that I'm putting a lot of weight into the standings right now as it's only April the 20th, but the Angels are 9-9. And I honestly feel like that's probably what they'll be this year. They'll hover around 500 and, you know, I suppose if you're the Angels, that might be the worst possible type of thing because maybe you talk yourself into, oh, we're at the deadline. We're only 2-3 games out of a playoff spot, and there are 3 wild cards now in each league in baseball, and you keep the guy. Can you imagine losing Shohei Ohtani for nothing? Like, again, most franchises would be smart and move on, but the Angels are stupider than most franchises, it feels like. Because, again, if you traded him in the winter, then there's a lot of teams whose expectations in January or February for the coming season are, yeah, we're going to compete. But then come July, they're like, we weren't actually a contender this year. So in other words, that's the kind of team that in February would say, yeah, I'll take Shohei Ohtani for a year and worry about signing him in due time because I think my team's going to be good in 2023. And then in July, I'd be like, we're not that good anymore. Like, I don't think I want to pay up the price for what would be 2 months of Shohei Ohtani. So if you're the Angels, it would have made way more sense to move this guy in the offseason last year. But they didn't do that already. So, like, that's my point. Like, they've already made some decisions with this guy where you can say, oh, okay, like, you're going to try and be good after not being good for this entire tenure that you've had him. Good luck with that. Here's what I will say. He will be the most expensive rental of all time that I can think of. I mean, it goes without saying the value that he brings to a club. And so if you get that guy for 2 months, could be a very fruitful 2 months. And so, in other words, how much more can he help you if you're a contending club come July than the traditional rentals that are always moved in July? And that's what these contenders will have to decide when it comes to the compensation that they're willing to send the Angels in terms of a prospect package, you would think. Although, again, maybe the Angels are like, well, you know, we'll take some major league talent back because we can sign these guys and we'll be good next year. You know, it's just the same thing with them, and they're not good. So, regardless, I think that it'll be fascinating to see how many teams are willing to pay for what is a guy who is still a rental, but as I said, the most expensive rental of all time. And will it just be teams that think they can win it all in 2023 the way it usually is in the rental market? Or would somebody say, hey, you know what? I don't know if I can win it all. I'm like a wild card and, you know, I'll see what happens. Maybe I get hot in October. But I do think that I have an infrastructure in place with my entire organization, with the way that we are constructed from an on-field product to off-the-field management, to where I give me this guy for 2 months and I will take my chances that I can sign him and that I can convince him that he should spend his prime with me. I mean, there could be some teams that try that. So, the entire Ohtani sweepstakes come July is going to be a lot of fun. And then when it comes to beyond July, like, do we trust the Angels to actually trade him? Because maybe they're the team that just says, well, we can convince him. Yeah, he hasn't signed yet, but we'll just outbid everybody. And if this is true, that he will definitely leave if they're not in playoff contention, then this is a guy who wants to win. Which, I talked a little bit about this yesterday. I'm never going to blame an athlete in any sport for wanting to win and for wanting to be in the best position to do that. So, on one hand, you look at the Angels and say, well, they're in Southern California. It's a big market there in L.A., but there's so many teams out there, and they're so far behind some of the other teams where, you know, it just doesn't really add up for me to think that there's any path towards him being an Angel in 2024. So, it, again, is a no-brainer that they should trade him, and it is a no-brainer that he should leave if he doesn't get traded. So it doesn't feel like this is that hard the next 3 months for the Angels, and maybe they just take it all the way down to the 11th hour and casting a wide net of suitors and go from there. But it's time to turn the page for this franchise and commit to a rebuild, have a little bit more of a direction. And for baseball, let's get Shohei Ohtani into the brightest of lights. No disrespect to the World Baseball Classic. That was a pretty cool thing. But I think we can all agree that we don't want the biggest moments of Shohei Ohtani's career just being in the World Baseball Classic, which is an event that's held every 3 years. So let's get this taken care of, and let's see him on a contender in the second half of 2023 and to see what kind of an impact he can have with a real team that can win games. We'll take a timeout and we'll come back. Jim Ozarski from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is on the other side.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
Let's go out to the Progressive Guest Line as we hit the hardwood with a recap of last night's blowout victory for the Milwaukee Bucks. Jim Ozarski from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, kind enough to join us as the Bucks get even with the Miami Heat, heading to South Beach now for games 3 and 4. Jim, good to have you aboard. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Good. So let me first ask this. Did you, I don't know, maybe if you got any opportunities to get some shots up. I was just wondering if the three-point shooting from the Bucks was contagious to everybody else in Fiserv Forum last night.
Yeah, you know, it was felt like anybody for
that's
sure
what I mean.
Was going to make one. Yeah, look, they've especially when Giannis doesn't play, they're going to put up even more than they normally do. And I believe they were fourth in the league in 3-point attempts. And you know, look, it is math to a degree. They shot 25% in game one. You kind of knew that wasn't going to hold. The Heat 60% in game one. You knew that was going to come down, and that's exactly what happened. Maybe a little more extreme than that, but yeah, the Bucks, without Giannis especially, need the three ball to fall. Pat Connaughton coming off the bench, Joe Ingles off the bench, and yeah, it was and Brooke Lopez kind of did the work inside. Total team effort in that way.
It was a record last night, 25 threes made by the Bucks, a playoff record for one game. And Jim, you mentioned Giannis's absence, and I wonder a little bit if, I know analytics in basketball have kind of, you know, boosted the desire for everybody to have three-point shooting, But was some of this with the way that they built the team a thought here of like, hey, you know, let's just get a bunch of shooters, and if Giannis, for whatever reason, isn't available, we can have games like we had last night because we'll just catch fire and make threes?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both in that, you know, Giannis, the way Giannis attacks the rim is so different than really anyone else in basketball that you kind of need some complementary pieces who are okay with kind of filling the space outside and being able to live with the fact that they may not shoot that many if Giannis has it going, if Chris Middleton has it going in the mid-range. And they're all capable shooters. I wouldn't call any of them, you know, sort of your dead-eye marksman. You know, you're not having any three-point contest guys. You're not having any guys who lead the league in three-point percentage. But they're all capable of the 6 three-point game like Pat Connaughton had. This is all the way down the line from Ingles to Grayson Allen, you know, Middleton to a degree. They all can do that. If Giannis is out, the sheer volume, at some point, one of those guys, if not multiple, are going to catch fire. So I don't think they're constructed in a way to help things if Giannis is out. I think the Bucks would love for him to play 70-plus
right.
games. But it does function that way when he does miss.
Gotcha. Okay. The other thing that I've noticed with these two games in Milwaukee, you mentioned the Miami Heat shooting really well in game one, and we talked about the Bucks shooting really well last night, but, you know, very high-scoring games. And I just wonder if going into the series, if you saw a lot of slugfest shootout-type games, or were both of these games kind of outliers in each direction?
Yeah, I think they're both outliers. You know, I mean, the Heat still shot really well in game two. I'm sure, you know, coaches always look for something, right? And the, you know, Mike Budenholzer, no doubt, is going to look at the Heat shooting over 50% again, 40% from three. It's just, you know, that wasn't enough. And the Bucks in game one, they scored 117 points. You know, typically that's
right.
enough to win a playoff game. So, yeah, there's a part of me that feels this was just an outlier. I could see the scoring depressed a little bit in Miami, regardless if Giannis plays or not, just because I feel, yeah, when you're hot, you're hot. And that's what happens in the NBA at this point. It feels unlikely over another three games that both of the – I mean, look, the Heat, one of the worst offensive teams in basketball. The Bucks without Giannis obviously have scoring, but that's 32, 34 points, 7 assists that are off the board. So,
right.
Yeah, it feels like going forward, maybe a little more of a defensive type of effort, I guess, or defensive-looking scores, if you will.
Let me ask you more specifically about Giannis. I think there was a time yesterday where he got upgraded from doubtful to questionable, and I think we saw the odds makers react accordingly. Point spread moved a little bit in Milwaukee's favor. Gamesmanship there? Was he close to playing? And what do you think happens between now and game three?
It could have been some gamesmanship, but I mean, Mike Budenholzer sort of clarified. He intimated that, per the league, if Giannis was doubtful at game time, to have him play doesn't seem like that would be allowed or, you know, looked kindly upon. So upgrading him to questionable gave them that option. But the fact that he was sort of ruled out immediately, he didn't warm up, and he warms up very, very early before games. It felt like maybe they just did that to, you know, sort of adjust in case. He
yeah.
decided he really wanted to go. I don't know. Look, his leg should have been blown to all kinds of pieces in that Eastern Conference Final 2 years ago, and there he was, you know, a week later, winning a Finals MVP. So with him, he's always got that thing where he comes back sooner than maybe he should, or than normal humans would. So it I guess the Bucks, you know, they've learned. You just maybe got to give them that chance, and then see what happens.
As far as Miami, I mean, I kind of went into this series thinking, okay, maybe it'll be kind of interesting because of that pedigree with Miami and that Heat culture that people talk about, going to a finals in 2020, conference finals last year. And then Giannis does go down, so obviously that aids the chances for Miami. I know Tyler Hero went down for the Heat, but what did you think about any real chance of a Miami upset going into the series? And do you think now that they did get the split and we have this Giannis uncertainty that the Miami Heat actually have a chance here?
I thought this was a five-game series at worst for Milwaukee. I mean, there's a reason the Heat weren't a play-in,
yeah.
Right? And winning one game, be it in Milwaukee or, you know, in a lot of these matchups, it tends to be game three, maybe game four at their home arena. The Giannis factor is interesting because, look, the Bucks are the better team. They're going to win the series. The hero loss is huge. I know Reggie Miller caught some stuff for this when it happened, but again, as we mentioned, they're the worst offensive team in basketball. You take away their arguably their most dynamic scorer in terms of the ability to catch fire and rain a lot of threes. The Bucks clearly know how to play without Giannis and score, you know, without him. So no, I think the Bucks will win. If you were to tell me they win in six because Miami steals one, not steals one, but you know, takes one at home because
right.
The Bucks again shoot 20%. Would I be shocked? No, but I don't. Yeah, they're just overmatched to me as long as the rest of the Bucks remain healthy.
So you mentioned the rest of the Bucks remaining healthy and Miami being a bit overmatched. Let's kind of end where we started, and that's with all the role players and everybody around Giannis, who obviously he wasn't there last night, but everybody else making a lot of threes. You cover the team on a daily basis. Do they feel like even despite the championship in 2021 that their non-Giannis players are still kind of league-wide a little disrespected?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They won't quite say it, but I feel like they feel it at times. You know, Brooke Lopez doesn't win DPOY. I don't know if Bobby Portis will win sixth man tonight or you know, maybe he should. We'll see what the all-NBA, all-defensive teams are. You know, Drew and Chris Middleton probably could have been all-stars each in the last couple of years. I think all at this level, they all look for something to motivate them to a degree. But yeah, I mean, look, they were the number one seed, and yet the whole week kind of waiting to see who they play, they were like, well, we're the hunter.
Yeah.
You know, even though we're the one seed. And I think some of that is to give Boston their respect
sure.
as the defending Eastern Conference champs. But I think the Bucks like the idea that even though they had the best record in basketball, there's maybe people aren't thinking about them or they're not talked about as much. But again, I think that has more to do with maybe their own self-created disrespect? Maybe.
Yeah.
But they're right. Definitely tapping into some of that.
Okay, sounds good. There's Jim Ozarski from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covers the Bucks as the Bucks and Heat get ready to play game three, not till Saturday in South Beach. But Jim, I lived in Minnesota for a little bit. I'm sure being up in Milwaukee, you'll welcome a trip to Miami this time of year, right? Oh, okay, we lost him. Well, I'm kind of a rhetorical question nonetheless, as I think the answer is an obvious yes. So on that note, we will take a timeout, and let's talk about the other series. Well, actually, there were two other series last night that were in action, but no disrespect to Minnesota and Denver. I just don't think that has a lot of pop and a lot of juice behind it, but certainly Memphis and the Lakers does, and the Grizz draw even last night at FedEx Forum. Dylan Brooks, not shy in opening his mouth. We'll play the cut and talk a little bit about the Grizzlies' win on the other side. First Name Sports, Sportsman Radio.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
Well, we are 1 week away from the NFL Draft, and we want to tell you all to spend draft night with our friends at VSiN. Their experts will be breaking down every pick and trade, as well as look for live betting values across the board. You'll hear from former NFL executive Mike Lombardi, Super Bowl champion quarterback Sean King, and all the VSiN betting experts. You can catch all of the action beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 week from today, April 27th, on the SportsMap Radio Network. As we roll on here on a Thursday afternoon, the Memphis Grizzlies even things up with the Los Angeles Lakers last night. on their home floor as the Grizz win what was obviously a must-win game, as I think particularly with the way the Lakers had been playing at the end of the regular season and the way they looked in game one in Memphis, the Grizzlies really could ill afford to lose both at home with 3-4-6 at Crypto. So they win 103-93. And I think the first thing, before we get into kind of the juicy radio topic from the game last night, is to acknowledge that there's a level of comfort that the Grizzlies have had, and we talked about it with our guest yesterday, without having Ja Morant on the floor. And it's interesting that both Memphis and Milwaukee both played very well last night without their superstars. And Memphis didn't waste any time. 30-19 at the end of the first quarter. Stretched it to a 15-point lead at half. And I think that is the sign of why these teams, both Memphis in the West and Milwaukee in the East, have the regular seasons they have. Because what's one thing that it comes up every year in basketball now is load management. And I think we just see more teams, even if it's not load management, err on the side of caution when it comes to injuries and day-to-day things with their stars. And so what happens is when you're a team like Memphis, when you're a team like Milwaukee, where you have a lot of depth, and let's call them a lot of unsung heroes maybe, where, you know, league-wide, I don't know that anybody, you know, how many people know Desmond Bane, or, you know, now Jaren Jackson Jr. won the Defensive Player of the Year for the Grizzlies, or, you know, Dylan Brooks, who we're going to get to. Like, they're not superstars, but it's a collection of above-average players behind your one real superstar. And that's kind of what the Grizzlies have nurtured so well, and that's kind of what the Bucks have spruced up there in Milwaukee. And so that's why you end up winning a lot of games in the regular season, because you have the depth to withstand the absence of your star. And then when your star's out in the playoffs, you're not fazed. And it's interesting because as I look up here on one of our TVs, there's an encore presentation of the Game 2 win for the Phoenix Suns over the Los Angeles Clippers. And Phoenix decided to trade depth for another high-end player in Kevin Durant at the deadline. And it feels like those are the two ways that you can skin a contender in the NBA. You obviously need one superstar. And you can opt to have a short bench and load up your starting five with at least two, maybe three superstars. Or you can go the Milwaukee-Memphis path of, okay, we have our face of the franchise. Now let's go 8-9 deep with guys that can play up and down the rotation. And when you think about it, Memphis and Milwaukee, I don't think it's a surprise that that's the path that they take, because those markets are not free agent destinations. So it's going to be a little bit harder to get more high-end talent to go there. Now, just as I say that, let's remember that the high-end talent that Phoenix acquired was mostly via the draft and via trades. But you catch my drift. Now, as it pertains to last night, the Grizzlies get even. We're going to Southern California for game three on Saturday night. And what appeared to be a pretty exciting series when the matchups were made official has delivered so far, I think. The Lakers played a very good game one. The Grizzlies were pretty good last night. And now we have a little bit of, I don't want to say bad blood, but some more meat on the bone. I don't know why I use that expression a lot. I feel like I say that once a show. But as John Belmer laughs in the producer studio. But Dylan Brooks decided to open his mouth about LeBron James last night. And, you know, I think much to the pleasantries of a lot of Lakers fans, game one, LeBron didn't need to do a lot and they still won. And won actually kind of going away down the stretch. And then the Grizzlies win last night. And so I'm sure they're saying, hey, you know, we're up in the series. Now, LeBron was better last night. He was 12 for 23 from the field with 28 points. But the Grizzlies are probably saying, hey, wait a second. Like, LeBron James isn't taking games over the way he used to be able to. And here's what Dylan Brooks had to say about LeBron.
You and LeBron have that exchange. There are people out there that say maybe you shouldn't do that with one of the better players in the game. Well, I guess what were you thinking?
I don't care. He's old. You know what I mean? I was waiting for that. I was expecting him to do that game four, game five. He wanted to say something when I got my fourth foul. He shouldn't have said that earlier on. But, you know, I poke bears. I don't respect no one until they come and give me 40. I pride myself on, you know, what I do is defense and taking on any challenge that's on the board.
Respect anyone until they come and give me 40. I don't care. He's old right away. And the funny part is Sam Quinn, CBS Sports NBA reporter, tweeted out that according to NBA.com tracking data, when guarded by Dylan Brooks, LeBron James in the first two games of this series shot 12 for 19 from the floor. So it's pretty good. Now, I suppose the volume with which Dylan Brooks is alluding to has not quite happened yet, but let's not act, Dylan Brooks, like you have shut down LeBron James so far. Far from it. Now, we just talked yesterday, actually most of the week, about Draymond Green, who was in the news because of the altercation with Domantas Sabonis on Monday night and will not play tonight in Game 3. Golden State Warriors, Sacramento Kings at the Chase Center in San Francisco. And it feels like a lot of these guys, Dylan Brooks, I don't know if we can include him in this group just yet, but he's kind of inching his way ever closer to that group. Draymond Green for sure, Marcus Smart, Patrick Beverley, the kind of junkyard dog, great defensive player who's got some skill and is not the best player on any team he plays for, but you always like a guy like that on your team. They're known for just being defensive pests and talking trash and getting into the head of offensive players and forcing them into bad shots and they make poor decisions, etc. And this is all part of that shtick, maybe, for Dylan Brooks, and he feels pretty confident in his ability to defend anybody in the league. But on the other hand, what are you doing? It's LeBron James. And we remember when Klay Thompson kind of laughed at LeBron during the 2016 finals in a press availability, saying, oh, I guess he just got his feelings hurt after a question was posed to Klay about some on-court beef between Klay and LeBron in the 2016 finals. And Cleveland ended up coming back from 3-1 down right after that press availability that Klay Thompson had, which LeBron James just kind of laughed off and ignored and let his play do the talking. And again, the Cavs ended up achieving the highest moment in their franchise's history. So we'll see how Dylan Brooks and LeBron James treat each other on Saturday night when this series shifts to L.A. Certainly figures to be a little more tasty. So some more butter on the popcorn, maybe. We'll say there. We'll take a timeout and we'll hit the ice, recap the action from last night's Stanley Cup playoff games. There were four of them. We'll discuss on the other side. First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.